Blog Talk Radio.
When I say straight, you say funk. Come on, straight.
Funk.
Straight. Okay.
Funk.
That's right. That's what I do is I give it to you straight. Good evening. This is your funkstress, Patrice Chocolate Banks, and you are tuned in to Everybody is a Star live on Tribe. I hope all of you have had a funked up week, okay? So now check this out. This is a special month for a few reasons. Number one, it's Black History Month. Also, it's a time when all you fellas go get out there and buy up everything and shower gifts on all of the ladies to show your love, right, on Valentine's Day, right? So because so much is going on in this month, I thought that this month needed a little swagitude, okay? So I thought to start out with, let's change February to Flavorary. Flavorary. Because, you know, if it's going to celebrate Black history, we bring what? A flavor. So, you know, it all one and one is always two. So it is officially Flavorary, okay? Now the next thing we need to do is kick off Flavorary with our guest tonight, who has been writing about music since 1988. Check that out, 1988. It is my pleasure, and I am excited to have Mr. A. Scott Galloway as our guest tonight. Hey, Scott.
What's happening, Chocolate? Happy Flavorary.
That's right. We're
going to keep it funky.
Yes, we
funky
are.
Funky Flavorary.
Welcome, and thank you so much for joining us on Everybody Who's Star. So now all you have to do is just pull up your chair and make yourself at home, okay?
I already feel it. It's such an honor and a pleasure and everything else to just be spending this time with you. I remember, you know, buying your records with Graham Central Station back in the day. And really enjoying particularly Release Yourself and really Ain't No Bout A Doubt It. That is just one of the all-time great funk albums of all time. And your singing, your funk box playing, and just your overall beauty and aura and vibe were very important to me when I was studying up on all that music I couldn't go to concerts to yet. So those albums were right at the top of my stack. So this is a very important moment for me just to kick it with you.
Wow. Okay, well, there you have it. That's enough. Okay, good night. No.
Thank you right so there. Much. Get no better than that.
That worked for me. Thank you so much. And I have been also following you. You are wonderful. And I see you all over the place all the time. So I'm so glad that you could take out this time to join us on Everybody is a Star tonight. So now what I do is I start from the beginning to the end, from the rooter to the tutor. Okay? So we're going to start out with you and where you were born. Let's start out with where you were born.
I was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ann Arbor was, of course, his college town. My father was studying for his PhD out there in engineering, aeronautical engineering. So that's where he and my mother had me. And I was there for all of 3 years. I have these vague memories of playing in the snow and some, you know, old family pictures that I've seen, but not a whole lot of solid memories about Ann Arbor. And we hopped in the car when my dad graduated and drove to California, specifically San Bernardino, with the Fifth Dimensions Up, Up, and Away album as our soundtrack. And I've been in California ever since.
Okay.
Yeah, you remember Up and Away, and it had California My Way on there, and Which Way to Nowhere. There's a whole lot of travel motif in that record, which was mostly composed by Jimmy Webb. So, yeah, that was our soundtrack coming out to California.
Isn't there something now? You can't remember a whole lot about Michigan per se, but you do remember the music.
No, when I was young, okay, I remember records, and I guess the story that my mom tells a lot is that even before I could read, I could pick out the records. I knew what records had which songs on them. And the classic one was Sunny by Bobby Hebb. You know, it was on that Blue Phillips label. And I don't know what was on the other side. I can't remember right now. But, Sunny was one word. And I think it had some little star. I always focused in on little details. There's like some little black star next to the title Sunny or whatever. And whatever it was, there was a visual cue that if my mom said, Scott, go get that record and play Sunny for me. I could go and find that record and put it on and play it. I remember Marvin Gaye's Greatest Hits being a very big record in our house at that time. I remember the double album, Diana Ross and the Supremes record being really big. And I remember Donald Byrd had this one album that he recorded on Verve entitled Up with Donald Byrd. Had a version of John Lee Hooker's Boom Boom on there with female background singers. And, it's like a jazz version of that. Those are like my first musical memories that I retain. And, it just kind of shows a little bit of the variety, just a taste of the variety that was going on in my household because, my mom listened to a lot of soul and pop and even some country type records, and my dad was heavy into blues and jazz. So I had a very beautiful melting pot of music that I was listening to right out of the gate, and I gravitated toward music out of the gate.
Right, and that was going to be one of my next questions. But before I was going to ask you about your musical influences, I was going to ask you about, I always have people shout out what school they went to because they like to do that. So did you go to school? Did you go to school in San Bernardino?
Yeah, I was only in San Bernardino for another 4 years, and wow, I think I went to... I think that school was either called Bemis or Henry. Those were the two schools. One was a school that I did not get to because I didn't stay. So I think it was Henry was the elementary school that I went to there. And then when we came to Los Angeles, I went to Baldwin Hills Elementary, Audubon Junior High School, and Birmingham High School in Van Nuys. Cal State University, Northridge.
Okay, so you went to Audubon and you went to Baldwin Hills, so it sounds like that you were over there in my stomping grounds. I was stomping around over there in that area and raised over there in that area. I went to Dorsey.
Ah, see, that's where I was supposed to go, feeding out of Audubon, but I decided to go to the valley and primarily just to check out some, what was going on the other side of the hill. I think it was primarily a good decision, but I was in a band at one point that all the other members went to Dorsey, and when we went there and turned out this talent show, that band was called Quest. Shout out to Carlos and Tim and Keith and all my girls in the group. Oh my goodness, the girls' names are escaping me. They're going to kill me. But we did a talent show over there. And, I was kind of looking around and it's like, man, I missed a little, there's some flavor that I missed.
Some flavor.
Not going to Dorsey. But Birmingham wasn't bad either. I played with some really bad cats in Birmingham. And, these guys were into progressive rock. They were into jazz rock fusion. And, I got to hang out with some other cats there. So, I think it was ultimately good for me. And, again, my people pulled me back into Dorsey. So I got a little taste.
I hear you. There's nothing wrong with being well-rounded. So,
that's right.
Now we're going to talk about your first musical influences, and it sounds like they started very early with your mom and your dad. They were music lovers, and you heard music around the house all the time. So, but when did you really feel, can you remember when you really felt that pull, you know, how when something is planted, a seed is planted, it starts blossoming. When did you know that music was something special, you know, really special, other than sounds that you just like to hear, but something that you were, you know, compelled to listen to?
Well, I think that would have to, you know, I think I came out of the womb beating on things. I was always very rhythmic. I was always, you know, beating on the tables and the floor and the back of the car seat, you know, when I was in the car. And so I was always into drums and percussion and that sort of thing. And so I think I always wanted to, you know, I was just always drawn to music. And then I found out that there was a gentleman, jazz legend Max Roach, who wasn't just the drummer, but he was the leader, and his face was on the album cover, and he looked really cool. His album was called Members Don't Get Weary on Atlantic Records, about 1968. And I was like, oh, you know, something just kind of clicked in my head that, you know, that this guy was really cool and special because he was a leader and he was the drummer, and drummers could be leaders, and I guess that's something that just said, I want to be a drummer. And over the years,
right,
I wanted to, you know, those are the three things I always wanted to do was I wanted to be a drummer, and I wanted to be a disc jockey on the radio. And, really, it was just those two things were the main things that I thought I wanted to do. And, of course, at some point, I wanted to work in a record store because that's where all the music was. And I got to do all of that through the course of my life.
Wow.
Okay. I got to do all of that.
So, okay, let's start out with probably the first phase of that was being a drummer. So, and you had groups. So how did that start? How did you start drum? Did you start putting little groups together yourself, or people found out you could play the drums?
It was all that good 70s neighborhood stuff. You know, I mean, my parents, initially, they didn't buy me a drum set. They bought me a snare drum. And I had this crazy little concert where they invited some of our next-door neighbors over. And I'm sitting there in the living room, and they put the Max Roach record on. This is the first song on the album called Abstrusions. And I'm sitting there playing the whole song on a snare drum. So I'm using the rim. I'm using the side of the drum. I'm using the drum playing this song, you know. And I was really nervous, and I think I kind of, like, played half of the song, and I would get really bashful and stuff. Particularly also because I had a crush on my babysitter, and she lived next door, and she was there. So I was probably tripping off of that. But anyway, that was, like, you know, the first experience. And then once we got to – that was in San Bernardino. Once I got to L.A., you know, there were people in the neighborhood that, you know, that played different instruments. And I think for my 8th or 9th birthday, I got a drum set.
Finally.
Yeah. So once that happened, then, you know, different friends, you know, came over with their guitars and basses, and, you know, and that's primarily what it was. It was guitar, bass, and drums, and we played funk, we played rock, we played stuff on the radio. I remember playing stuff like Slide by Slave and all the way to Rick Springfield, you know, Don't Talk to Strangers. I mean, we played whatever was cracking, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I got to high school is when we got a little bit more serious. And, you know, I was in some bands, and we actually played up and down. You know, we got to play the clubs that were on, you know, Sunset. We played the Roxy. We played the Whiskey. We played the Troubadour. We played Madam Wong's, which is no longer around. We played at My Place, which became the Temple Bar much later. We got around, and we played some school campuses and stuff too. So, nothing happened with those bands. I mean, you know how it is. Those are just, you know, just little local friends playing and getting dressed up, and you invite your family and your friends. They come out, and you're out in the nighttime playing these gigs. But, you know, nothing happened, but it was a lot of fun.
But you guys had to be pretty good. Those clubs that you just named, I mean, you know, that's not chopped liver. So
no.
You guys had to be, yeah. So what was
Oh, no, we were good.
Was there one particular band or several different bands that you played at these different venues?
One was called The Truth, and with the E at the we had an E at the end of it, and and then another one was called The Leap. I think The Leap was more of a kind of a takeoff on what The Time was doing. You know, all dressed up and, you know, funky kind of stuff. The Truth, we were trying to be like the Black Police. And we, you know, all original tunes. And, you know, my song that I wrote and sang was called I Guess I'm Funny That Way, which was about kind of being jealous or having a girlfriend that's always trying to make you feel jealous because she's always telling you about dudes hollering at her. So I wrote this song called, you know, I Guess I'm Funny That Way. And we had another song that the bass player Bill wrote called Mall Girls, hanging out at the mall. And
right.
The guitar player Tim brought a lot of different songs in. One was called Shut Up and Go. We had instrumentals, we had vocals. It was kind of new wave, punk, funk, you know, but at essence, we were trying to have that energy of the Police, because I mentioned Max Roach already, but my main drummers that really influenced me were Max, Stuart Copeland of the Police, Steve Ferroni of the Average White Band, and Tony Williams, the great pioneer of jazz rock fusion drumming. So those were my idols, and so that's the kind of energy that I was trying to bring to what
mm-hmm.
I played. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, how long did this career last?
career.
Yes, how long did this career last? This musician career.
That was like high school into early college. And also in high school, we did we put together a show called Master Jam, which was something else entirely, where we had a big production where we did everything from Chaka Khan's Night in Tunisia to Earth, Wind & Fire, Pride, and we did jazz. We did a whole bunch of stuff, and that was a big nighttime program that actually put us into debt. we had to pay off because we like hired, you know, horn players from college because the high school cats couldn't hang. I mean, it was just, I mean, we just really thought we were going to be like, you know, the next Earth, Wind & Fire. My friend John Bukowski was the guy that put most of that together. He was my classmate, and he did go on to really do great things. He went out of high school and about within a year, he was playing with Tina Marie. He's a really bad cat, and he's still out. But, you know, again, we did our thing. We were very serious. And, yeah, so that lasted till then. And I also played drums in cabaret shows. So I was playing behind singers and, you know, and they had little choreography and stuff. And, I mean, this was stuff where we were doing the 1920s through the 40s, I believe, kinds of tunes. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was total cabaret kind of stuff. So that got my little... You know, that's when I felt like I was doing professional, you know, stuff, you know, playing these gigs behind other people. And, you know, so I had a nice little taste of things. Nothing ever went big, but, you know, I can say that I was a professional musician, and I also got to play all those great clubs on the strips and stuff. So, you know, I claim it. I love it.
Well, you can say you're a professional musician if you get paid, okay?
That's right.
It sounds like at some point you did get paid, so there you go.
Yeah, backing those cabaret singers, I was getting paid. Doing the other stuff, we were just having a whole lot of fun, and I don't think we had to pay to play quite at that time period, because that was like the next phase of the clubs where bands had to actually pay to play, which was crazy.
Right.
I think we
right.
came in just before that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cool. And you know, like I said, we brought a whole nother flavor, you know, because we were up there playing amongst all these other primarily white rock bands, but we were doing our thing. So that's just how the strip was back then.
Right, it was. And it was, I was roaming up and down Sunset Strip there for a while, gigging and
you
doing
were doing it for real, though.
Yeah. That was a magic time. The Sunset Strip had a whole different vibe in those days, and it was the real thing, you know what I'm saying? The real thing. The stuff that they're doing now, like you say, this pay-for-play stuff is insane.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the Roxy and the Whiskey and the Troubadour, you know, those were like, if you got in there and were playing, you were doing the dadgum thing. Okay, so what happened next? Your musician career.
Well, during that same time period, a lot of my stuff overlaps, and so you know, also when I graduated high school, I turned 18 and I got a job working at Warehouse Records, which was a record store chain. I started off
right.
in the Fox Hills Mall store as a clerk, and I ended up being the buyer for the one of the biggest stores in the chain, if not the biggest, which was store number 502 on the big corner of La Brea and Rodeo Road. And I was very proud of that. That was a great time. You know, big store. I was buying all music, so I was buying rock and, you know, jazz, soul, everything for that store. And it was great. And then I segued into working at the only radio station I ever wanted to work for, which was the Quiet Storm, KUTE. I got an internship there, blew all the other interns out of the water, and they found a position. They created a position for me. I'm not bragging, but I mean, that was the only station I wanted to work at. And I was there for 2 to 3 years. And once that format went away, I just really wasn't that interested in doing radio anymore, because we played such an incredibly sophisticated blend of music there: world music, jazz music, R&B, you know, rock, easy listening kind of stuff, and we blended it in a certain way, and it was just the music of my heartbeat. And so I was very fortunate, and once I got to do that, it's like, okay, well, I've done radio, I worked in a record store. Didn't know where my future was going to go after that, but somebody called me in to start working at this brand new trade publication called Urban Network, and I was called in just to do some phone work, you know, calling record stores across the country and getting their sales figures. And I hated that job because I just felt like I was being lied to every week. They'd tell me anything, and this was before SoundScan, and so, you know, everybody was in everybody's pocket, so it's just, we sold 100 Whitney Houstons this week. Yeah, that's the ticket. And I'm like, okay. You know, it was crazy. But then, you know, they found out that I know a lot about music and that I could write a little bit. I became the music editor, and I started interviewing all sorts of people and writing reviews, and, you know, it all snowballed from there. Now, one thing I want to say is that when I was at the radio station, I did a lot of research for the air personalities there for their radio shows, particularly Talia. And I got to do
Talia.
My...
Mm-hmm, I remember
Talia.
Her. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And she's still on the... Now she's on the Wave, because when the Quiet Storm... I think, yeah, when the Quiet Storm went away, she segued right over to the Wave, and she's still there. I think she just celebrated, my goodness, I think it was her 30th anniversary last year.
Wow.
Over at the Wave. Yeah, so I worked for her. I used to do, kind of help her with some of her shows. And one time I did all this research for her on a Nancy Wilson interview that she was supposed to do. And at the last minute, she couldn't do it. And so they made me do it. And so my very first interview of my whole life was Nancy Wilson, which you can imagine was pretty monumental. But she was so cool, and I was so prepared because I had prepared it for someone else to do, but, you know, I had done the prep, so it was all good. It
so
was all good.
You probably weren't even nervous, huh? Was it over the phone?
No, it was in person. She came, no way, this is radio. She came into the station looking beautiful, regal, just wonderful Nancy Wilson, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I should say she was beautiful and regal in her essence, but she was just kicking it because it was radio. You know, she wasn't going to be on TV or anything, so she was just natural. She wasn't like in a gown or anything. Just, you know, I forgot what she was wearing. But the thing that made me nervous was that we had to do this interview in the main production studio, and I always tell people that it would be my trial by fire. So I had to record it on reel-to-reel, you know, using the mixing board and all this equipment and, so in beyond me having to deal with interviewing her, I also had to be my own engineer and record this thing and have everything set up properly for a broadcast. So, yeah, it was a little, it was daunting, but it was wonderful. And so I just
I
say all that to say that Nancy Wilson was the first person I ever interviewed. And then when I got to the Urban Network magazine, the first group I ever interviewed for them was 2/3 of the Fat Boys.
You said 2/3 of the Fat Boys, okay.
Yeah, because the Human Beatbox, you know, he didn't come in that day. So the other two guys came. I think Prince Marky D was one of the guys. I forget who the other guy was, but Prince Marky D was one of the guys. So you see how crazy my career has been.
You know what? I love it because it's so diverse. And like I said, you know, all that experience that you had, all the different types of experiences that you had was just setting up the foundation for you to end up being the person you are today and doing the kind of work that you do today. So, you know, there's always a plan. There's always a master plan. And so this is obviously what yours was. So
yeah.
Now... let's go to we have callers on the phone.
Oh my goodness!
Waiting. Yes, we do. So let me see. We'll take a caller right after we do this first song on your list that you submitted. But before I play the song, I just want to say that let me see. I'm reading a little bit off your bio right now, but.
Mm-hmm.
I said that you have been writing about music since 1988 for magazines that include Urban Network, Wax Poetics,
mm-hmm.
and the UK's Blues and Soul, interviewing artists from Max Roach to – oh, you got to interview Max Roach to
yes,
Maxwell.
I did.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
and your specialty niche is composing liner note essays for reissues and compilations of classic recordings. And you've
mm-hmm.
done, like, over 300 of those, okay? So for
yeah.
all of you guys who don't know, now you know, okay? 300, that's a lot, okay? That is a lot. So now on your off of your list, the first song that we're going to play is one of my favorite songs. And the song, I'm going to let you introduce it. Did I tell you what it was? Well, anyway, it's Water. So tell us why you chose Water to be on your list.
Oh, okay. You started with the oldie.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
well, you know, the first reason I had to pick Water is because I was going to be spending this time with you, and Water is my favorite song by Graham Central Station, and what I always loved about Graham. I mean, you guys had your own vibe. I mean, you know, I grew up loving all the funk bands. I mean, from Ohio Players to Commodores, Earth, Wind & Fire, Blackbirds, Isley Brothers, everybody, P-Funk. But Graham Central Station, along with Billy Preston, y'all had the organ and the clavinet, bass, drums, guitar, and then you with the funk box and everything. And on top of all that, not only were you guys bringing the serious, serious funk, but you had this deep messages, and this song even like is quoting, like, you know, scripture from the Bible, or at least if not all out scripture on this song. I'm sorry, I know the album cover had scripture from the Bible on it, but the song, like, just name checks God and Satan, and it's really is talking about sin and getting your life together. And I was just like, whoa, you know, on what would still be technically considered to be a funk record. Now, you know, and then this stuff would just get you lifted. I mean, you know, the horns on here, it was just wonderful. It was incredible music. I can't even come up with the right word for it. I've always loved this song, so I wanted to, you know, we're going to play it, and then I just wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about that direction that you guys, you know, were in, and how deep that was to tour and party and do everything with all the other funk groups, but you guys were on another spiritual plane. So after people
okay.
listen to this song and hear what these lyrics are going to come with, and with all that funk up underneath it, I want to just rap a little taste about that.
No problem. So here we go. Water, GCS.
Yeah.
Until your dying day, you'll be quiet.
Now you know that is funk for real, okay? So now, Doe, it's your turn.
Well, my question was just, I mean, for you guys to bring songs that were that explicitly, you know, biblical and spiritual and you know, really proselytizing, you know, through the music. And you guys were playing on bills with, you know, everybody else, you know, wasn't separate, you know. What was that like, you know, and how strong was that mission that you guys were on in trying to, what it sounds to me, you know, saving souls through the funk?
Okay. Well, one thing about me, Scott, is I keep it real, okay? So you're getting ready to get a real answer right now.
I know, that's right.
So. At that point when the music and the lyrics, well, the music was still funky, but at that point when the lyrics were going in the direction they were going in was because Larry had become a Jehovah's Witness. And
right.
Like he was on fire. You know what I'm saying? He had gotten baptized and he was on a mission. So his mission was to like, save everybody's soul, you know. So, but that was his mission. You see what I'm saying? Now, I am a preacher's kid. So I have been in church all my life. So did not have a problem at all with the spiritual because we had done songs prior to that, you know, music prior to that that was definitely gospel, Release Yourself. That wasn't nothing but a church song. Definitely gospel.
Yeah.
But when at the point where the lyrics started becoming so religious, you know, that was a direction that Larry wanted to go in. It was not a direction that Graham Central Station, per se, wanted to go in. So that caused some problems. And that caused the eventual disbanding of the original Grand Central Station as it was, because, you know, it was fine for him to, you know, do his thing and be excited about what he was into, but and have his vision, but it had to be everybody's vision in order for it to be successful. You know what I'm saying? We, you know, we all had to be on the same page in order for us to all be able to get the same message over with the same conviction that he had. And frankly, you know, the group did not want to be. The rest of the members of the group did not want to, because we turned into like a funk gospel group. And that's not what we were trying to do. We were, you know what I'm saying? So So that caused a problem, and that caused dissension.
Was a funk song. You know, that was a funk
right.
song. But, I mean, you had other songs like Luckiest People and other things
right.
that were that sounded like really more like church music, or they were more sedate and more what you would imagine being more traditional ways of, you know, getting the word across through music. But the reason why Water was so incredible is because it was over that funk. That's a classic
Absolutely.
Song.
Absolutely. So we agreed with the funk. We wanted to keep it funky, but the message was not a message that, because we weren't all Jehovah's Witnesses. So a message that message was something that all of the group was not interested in relaying. You know what I'm saying? We just wanted to do the funk, continue to do
wow.
funk like we have been doing. So as far as you know, being out there on the road with the other acts that we would be, you know, playing with. Actually, Water didn't really get played a lot live. We didn't do Water live really much. We mostly did, you know, the songs that, you know, the most popular songs, the Can You Handle It and all that. Very seldom did we do Water. So it didn't really matter. But, and I don't know how this is going to sound, but it's just really the truth. It didn't really matter what we played, because it was so funky, until a lot of times whenever we did play Water, people were funking so hard to the music that the words, you know, the message didn't really get across really the way Larry was hoping that it would, because people were, you know, distracted by that funk. You know, the funk will distract you. So they were busy partying, you know what I'm saying? So nothing really changed in, you know, in that aspect of it. Nothing really changed.
Well, my hat's off to you all, though, for, you know, even if it was primarily Larry's vision, so just to make that attempt. Because, you know, I know that folks was partying hardy and the words probably went right over their head, but it was the attempt that is honorable. Because also in that time, you know, Lewis Johnson and his wife Valerie at the time, you know, spun off out of the Brothers Johnson and had a band called Passage that was very important at that time for, you know, trying to bring a message through the music, as was this great band out of Hawaii called Sea Wind. So I just, you know, who were, you know, like a jazz, funk, fusion type of group and had crazy chops. And, of course, their horn section went on to work with everybody. But, you know, they were about having music that was just as funky and just as hip as anything else on the radio. But they had the message. And I've always felt like that's what was, you know, that's really all that was going to work if you were trying to, you know, go into the world and save some souls. That's what you had to do. The music had to be as on point as what they were jamming to in the club, at the house party, and on the radio.
Absolutely. If that is your purpose, then that absolutely needs to happen. And I do want to say that, you know, for those who did take time out to listen to the lyrics of that song and a few other songs on that album, because there were a few other songs that had spiritual lyrics, that, you know, it did serve its purpose as far as that part is concerned. You know what I'm saying? It did serve its purpose. Because I still get people today asking me and commenting about those songs, just like you are right now, believing that it was intentional you know, for that we were out to win souls, you know what I'm saying? But
yes.
The reality of it was that was not Grand Central Station's intention, that was Larry's intention. So he, you know, he was successful at that to a certain extent.
Beautiful.
So did,
that's beautiful.
So did I answer your question?
Yes, you did. I mean, there's so much more. You know, one day I hope to do a liner note essay about Ain't No Bout to Doubt It. I was really disappointed when Warner Brothers reissued all that Grand Central Station stuff, and the notes were like about 3 paragraphs with no depth and no interviewing anybody, and now some of those musicians are no longer here. And we haven't even gotten into, you know, like that's like one of the most important things about the work that I do is, you know, getting the voices and the perspectives of the people that were involved in creating this music. And so that's one that got away from me. And so, you know, I appreciate you indulging me and sharing a little bit of what I would have included in a liner note essay about Ain't No Bout to Doubt It had I had a chance to do the liner note essay.
I hear you, no problem. And also a lot of what I just told you is in my book, Deja Vu, Memoirs of a Funk Diva, which we have to make sure you get your copy. That'll give you a lot more insight. So now at this point, we are going to take a call. Hopefully they are still there. the area code is 240. Caller, are you there? Area code 240.
Yeah, this is your buddy Billy Best in Washington, D.C.
Hi, Billy. Whoa. How come I don't know? I never know.
It's okay.
You always, oh, my God, I'm going to have to write that down. When it's 240, it's Billy Best.
Absolutely. Hey, Scott.
What's happening, Billy?
How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. Good to talk to you. I see you on Facebook all the time. And
all the
it's
time.
Great
that's
to...
right. That's... I love your work, man. I'm just I saw that you were going to be the guest tonight, and I said, oh, yeah, I got to stay up and check you out. And, of course, my queen, I just love her always and everything she does and everything she touches. So I'm so glad
you
I got
are the
to
best.
Check you out, man.
Thank you so much for staying up, man. Where are you
yeah,
calling
but...
from?
From D.C.
You
oh, so it's,
D.C.,
it's late.
Baby.
It's going on midnight.
Chocolate City.
Are you taking part in any of the BET Honor stuff out there?
No. No, my cousin.
Okay, I know.
Cousin that will be, but not me. But she's worked with BET in the past, and Kelly Richardson. She's on my Facebook page. But yeah, I love all your work. I love all the things you teach us and we learn from, well, first of all, from both of you, really. I mean, that's what you are out there doing is educating us and helping us to learn about music and especially about the funk from my Queen Chocolate. So
absolutely.
I just wanted to call in and listen and just say thank you for all you do, and hopefully I get to meet you one day.
We're going to have to make that happen, man. I hope if
yeah,
I come to D.C. or you come to L.A., we're going to make
yeah.
that happen. And before
okay.
that, maybe we can Skype or something.
Okay.
He needs to come to L.A. Billy Bash, you need to come to L.A.,
I do.
Okay? You
I
need
do.
To work
I
that
do.
Out and come to
okay.
L.A. And thank you so much. Billy is part of Team Chocolate. It's Billy Bash, Ray Williams, and Zelda Norwood, and I love them so much. They have supported me through all of this that I'm trying to do. And smooches, Billy. Thank you. And now you can go to bed.
Thanks for hanging, Billy. And shout out to Zelda. Z, I know. Z is out here, and I see her
yeah.
all the time on the funk scene. Yeah.
Right.
Hey,
right.
But
she be holding it down.
It's Friday night, though, Billy. You're not trying to go to bed, are you?
Sometimes I can stay up and hang, and then some weeks, you know, it's a week to week.
I hear you, my brother.
I hope you stay tuned. We got some more good music coming up for you, and there's hopefully some compelling conversations. So hopefully you can hang in there with us a little bit longer.
Well,
if not for the full 2 hours, just a little more, a little taste more.
Yeah. Well, listen, it was easy for me to what you just went through because Chocolate had all of that information in her book, and so
yeah.
I was already familiar with what she was going to say about, you know, that particular song, Water, and the direction between the ain't no Doubt About It, Ain't About a Doubt It album, and the Mirror album was
when they really kind of went
off in that direction. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So,
Mirror was a whole nother story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Billy Best, I love you, and thank you so much for calling in. And try to hang with us, because it's going to be a good one, okay? All right.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Peace,
bye-bye.
Billy.
Bye.
All right. So now, back to you, Scott. So now, after we left off with you interviewing Nancy Wilson, and then going
and that was
to
at the Quiet Storm.
Yeah,
so once I interviewed Nancy at the Quiet Storm, then I, you know, they started having me do more interviews.
The magazine, right.
Yeah, yeah, and actually I always forget, Nancy was the first artist I ever interviewed in person, but the very first artist that I ever interviewed, period, was a phoner, a phone interview, and it was a big mistake on my part. You know, I'll tell you who the person was in a minute, but, you know, I got the person on the phone, and I wrote all this information down, and we were going to have this incredible, you know, lunch hour special is the name of the show, you know, and so I get all this information, and I go run into the program director, who's Lawrence Tanner, and I told him what I had done, and he said, Scott, you did record that, didn't you? and I was like, no, you know, and immediately I just knew I had made a big mistake, because, of course, it was radio, and he wanted me, you know, he said I should have recorded the interview so that they could use the person's actual answers, his voice, on the radio. But I just got the information. I said, okay, well, we're just going to play the songs, and then, you know, Talia will say, you know, the background behind these songs, and we'll play them. And that's what we ended up doing. But anyway, the person that I interviewed first was Clarence Skip Scarborough, who's an amazing songwriter.
Absolutely.
He was no longer with us. And so I'm hurting that I don't have that on tape, because, I mean, he's gone. I would love to have had that. And I asked him about all the songs that he had written for, you know, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Can't Hide Love, Love Changes for Mother's Finest. I don't have to tell you all the emotions. Don't Ask My Neighbor.
He was a man for a long time. He was on top of the game for a long time.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
He was amazing. He was a wonderful interview. He was so sweet, so, you know, forthcoming, and very happy that we were doing the special on him. I remember when we aired the special, Denise Williams called the station because she had heard it in her car, heard us doing this hour-long tribute to her friend, and she called in and thanked us. And, you know, it was an amazing hour, that whole show. So, hey, you live and learn. So that was a hard lesson.
Right. Don't you just love that, though? Don't you just love the fact that you were able to talk to him? That's why I do this show, is because it is my mission to keep funk alive and reposition the funk and make sure that funk is in its rightful place in music history, which I think it is not, but it needs to be. So that's part of my mission, to keep the funk alive. So talking to people like you and all my other guests that I have on the show, you know, it's history, and I learned that lesson early, and I have all of my interviews, and I'm going to do something real special with them. But, you know, just to be a part of the history of funk in any aspect is one of the reasons why I am put here. You know, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. So I don't even know what I would be doing if I wasn't doing this. You know what I'm saying? And
I feel
so
you 200%.
Yep, absolutely. So it is all good. So, okay, because I look at you as a historian. I think that you have put in your time and paid your dues, my brother.
Thank you so much for saying that. I really I feel like I have, but it's been mostly 95% a pleasure and an honor just to do that. You know, I mean, when I get assignments, it's really about the opportunity and the excuse for me to go calling up people and banging on their doors and, you know, excuse me, but can I talk to you for a half hour, an hour, you know, and get this history from you? You know, I mean, come on.
Right.
It's just all the people that I sat up and listened to before I, you know, like I said, before I could get out there and start seeing shows, which I started doing at a really young age. I remember being the youngest person in clubs sometimes when I went to go see stuff, taking the bus and going to see Chaka Khan at the Roxy for the What You Gonna Do For Me album. And, you know, people offering to drive me home, because by the time the show was over, it's like midnight or something, and I'm like, no, can't have none of that. You know, I know
right.
what my bus schedule is. I know how to get home. But, I mean, it was like that. I was, like, the youngest person. I was the first in line. I was, like, getting the best seat. You know, Shaka walked out on my table doing Tell Me Something Good. And I'm like, yeah, moving drinks out the way with her foot. You know, it's just, you know, I was that kid, you know, just out there.
I heard that. Serious. This is what I'm talking about. Okay, so now we're getting ready to play this next song on your list called Messages from the Heart. Now tell us about that, why you chose this one.
Messages from the Heart is from one of the sweetest, wonderful ladies on this planet and in this city, and her name is Sherry Brown. She is an amazing singer, songwriter. She used to have came to prominence for most people, became aware of her in the early 80s. She did two albums on Capitol, and she's gone on to do a lot of collaborating with Patrice Rushen, who's a longtime friend of hers and everything. She's written a children's book called Jaka Naka and everything, but her latest album is called Messages of the Heart, and it's basically the prelude and companion to another book that she's doing that's very special. It's going to be an inspirational book about women's journeys, and I can't really speak too much more in depth about it because it would take all night, but it's an amazing book that she's already completed, so she's introducing the concept of it through this album. And the title track of the album, Messages of the Heart, is really special because she collaborated with the great Leon Ware, who was a very good friend of mine. Just an amazing guy. We know that he's, you know, written everything from several songs for Minnie Riperton that he collaborated on with her and her husband, Dick Rudolph, like Inside My Love and whatnot, to Maxwell's Something Something, and, of course, the entire I Want You album from Marvin Gaye, which was originally his album, and then he gave it to Marvin, and Marvin did his little magic with it. I shouldn't say little magic, you know, he did his magnificent magic with it, and it became one of the boudoir masterpieces of all time. But anyway, Messages of the Heart is a collaboration between Sherry Brown and Leon Ware, and I just wanted
the legendary Leon Ware. I mean, he's a giant.
Yes,
okay?
He is. I'm going to tell everybody to listen to these lyrics. Listen to the lyrics. Sherry Brown and Leon Ware together wrote some really hip lyrics, very heart piercing lyrics. So, you know, while you're floating on that music, because it's real sweet, be sure to listen to the lyrics. All right, go
okay.
ahead.
Here we go. Messages from the Heart.
It's what's deep inside.
Okay, so everybody don't sleep on Sherry.
Sherry Brown.
not Sherry, Sherry, okay? Sherry Brown. Yeah, don't sleep on her. And Leon Ware, Giant. Maybe you can do something. You said he's a good friend of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. We ride bikes together. He's my bicycle buddy. So a lot of times we ride up to Malibu. From Venice to Malibu and back, and he's such a philosophical cat and a funny cat and just, you know, a legend. It's just incredible to me that I can just call him my friend, you know, and hang out with him and glean his knowledge and vibration. You know, he's
yay. Well,
wonderful.
You know,
he and his wife Carol, wonderful people.
Okay, cool. Well, that's good. I am very glad. That is wonderful information. And I'm gonna get back to you on that. So now,
please do.
I am. So now, some of your liner credits include the 25th anniversary deluxe 2 CD reissue of Curtis Mayfield's Superfly, the Real Quincy Jones compilation of the composer conductor's film music. Let me see. A deluxe 24-karat gold edition of Sly and Family Stone, There's a Riot Going On, okay? Let me see, Stellar Funk, The Best of Slave and Steve Arrington.
Yep.
Donny Hathaway's Extension of a Man. Wow, I could go on and on and on, but I'm going to leave it right there. I'm going to leave it right there for right now. I have some other ones I'm going to mention later, though. But so... how did you start writing liner notes? How did that happen? I want to hear how that happened.
I have a very good friend named David Nathan. He is called the British Ambassador of Soul. And he and I became friends just through the you know, the music industry. And one day, so the very first time that we decided to hang out, he came over to my apartment, and we were just talking, and I remember us talking about Laura Nero and just all sorts of different music that we were kind of bonding on. And then he started telling me that he was working for Atlantic Records, or for Rhino, because Rhino had just acquired the Atlantic Records catalog, and they were going to be reissuing all these great classic records from the Atlantic catalog. And David's emphasis has always been, you know, he loves all kinds of music and all kinds of R&B, but he really loves the divas. He actually wrote a book about the divas of R&B, like Phyllis Hyman and Aretha Franklin and Dionne Warwick and all of that. So he was really focusing in on the ladies. And I just very casually and nonchalantly said, you know, whenever they get around to putting out the Average White Band stuff, I would love to do it because, you know, I'm really into bands. I'm a musician. I'm a drummer. Steve Ferroni, who played with Average White Band, is one of my favorite cats. So if they ever get around to doing that, you know, say, you know, put a good word in for me. Next thing I know, like a week later, I got a phone call from James Austin, who was an A&R at Rhino, and he said, you know, David Nathan told us that you're our guy for the Average White Band, and, you know, almost dropped the phone. You know, first project I did for them was the very best of the Average White Band, and they called it Pick Up the Pieces, the best of the Average White Band, and I just, you know, I did what I do. So, you know, I got that assignment, and I went out, and I found Alan Gorey and Hamish Stewart and Ani McIntyre and Roger Ball and Malcolm Molly Duncan, all the members of the band that were alive. And I interviewed them all to get their perspectives. And I think, they were very impressed by that because I think at that time most of the writers that were getting those assignments would either just write things from their own perspective or they would be satisfied with getting one band member, you know, and, okay, well, you know, that person will cover everything and let me just get this little quick money. And I was a fan, so I wanted to really – I had all these questions that I wanted to know as a fan, and I wanted to share that information with the people. So that's the way I approached the notes, and that just kind of became my MO. And so other record companies started calling me once they saw what I was doing, and my career snowballed from there. The one thing, though – the other thing, though, is that actually before that – there was a gentleman that I worked with by the name of Bill Speed. He was my second editor at Urban Network. Now, he also was in the mix because he gave me a project to do, which was actually my first liner note project. I think the record company came to him to do them, and he said, you know what, I think you need to, you know, have my guy Scott, you know, who works with me here, do them. And that was a project called Rap Declares War. And that project was really in-depth because it was a project that was all about rap groups that sampled songs by the band War. So not only did I have to know all about War and the songs that were sampled, I had to know about each one of these different hip-hop groups that did the sampling. And because I was working at Urban Network, then, you know, I was totally, that was the stuff that was going on at the time, all that hip-hop.
Right.
And all those groups, primarily West Coast groups, but there were a couple of East Coast ones too, like Poor Righteous Teachers. Anyway, all that information was right at my fingertips, and so I put that together. So that's basically, between those two projects, that's really how I got started. And, you know, like I said, today I've done, you know, over 300, and it's my favorite kind of writing to do because it's writing that's attached to the music, attached to the music. If somebody's listening, they bought the CD and they have a question about something they're listening to, I hope that when they go to my liner notes, their answers and more are there. And it's not like you got to go to the internet or back in the day, like you got to go to the library or you got to go find some old magazine or something that hopefully will have some information. It's right there with the music. So it's my favorite writing. And I do all kinds of writing. I've written for magazines too, but to me, there's nothing like writing liner note essays for CDs.
Okay, and so what makes you different is that you actually, like you said, is part of your MO, you actually go and seek out the artist. So what you do is you interview the members of the group or the artist or whatever before you write the notes.
Absolutely. And sometimes that also encompasses, I mean, with Average White Band, it was a whole group of people to talk to. And I thought it was really important to talk to everybody. Also, because, you know, with R&B, and that happened to be a white band, or, you know, they're from Scotland and whatever,
right.
Doesn't make any difference. But the thing for me, though, and I don't know if I've ever shared this before, but there was a project that was out right when David Nathan and I were having that hang in my apartment that was done on the band Chic. And the liner notes were so disappointing to me. I mean, and I'm being kind to say disappointing. All the perspective was from the writer, and he was rehashing really basic kinds of information about the band. And I said, you know what, if, you know, somebody should have talked to Nile Rodgers, they should have talked to Bernard Edwards and Tony Thompson and Lucy Martin and Raymond Jones and everybody, you know, just, you know, get different, you know, it's like that's a fan perspective. You know, that's what fans want. People that are really into the music, they want to know what those people think about the music. They don't care about you telling us that it went to number one and, you know, it did this and that, and, oh, Europe was on fire and the dance floors were crazy. It's like, whatever. You know, it's like we want to know, you know, who inspired Nile Rodgers to play and how the band got together and, you know, what was the session like and, you know, what was it like the first time they heard it on the radio and what inspired this and all that kind of stuff. That's what people really want to know. That was my gut feeling because that's how I felt about it. So,
mm-hmm.
So like I said, with the average white band, it was a band situation. But if it's just a single artist like Tina Marie or someone, then, you know, I'm interested in talking to the producer, the arranger. I mean, in that case, you know, Tina did a lot of that, but her session musicians, Paul Reiser, who did the strings on this song, and, you know, John Bukowski, my friend, who, you know, what was it like to be, you know, going from high school and then, you know, your first gig is Tina Marie. What was she like? What was it like, you know, how did she treat you as a young newcomer? All these kinds of things. I mean, that's kind of where my mind goes. It's like, let's get this information because where else is it going to go? You know, if somebody writes a book about Tina Marie, they're not going to ask her in-depth information about this album or this song. They're going to want to talk about her life and this big journey, you know. They're not going to go
right.
over these little details. So that's
right,
kind of where
right.
I hear
you.
What I do. Yeah.
Absolutely. And exactly. And I know exactly what you're talking about because that's what Everybody Is a Star is about. Because, you know, we know about the stars. We know about that one that is up front, you know. But what about the musicians that support? What about the background vocal support? What about
mm-hmm.
the songwriters? Everybody. It takes like a whole team of people to make somebody a quote-unquote star. So, you know, let's dig and let's find out everything that we can find out, you know, about everybody that was involved. And so, you know, I definitely know where you're coming from when you're talking about that. So,
yeah.
Now,
and on the other end of the spectrum, you know, I understand why some writers and a lot of people didn't do all that because you don't get paid a whole lot of money to do this. A lot of it is truly labor of love, mission, stuff from the heart. You know, you kind of have to do a lot of these projects as opposed to a little of them to make it worth your while, you know. But
mm-hmm.
it's, like I said, it's just kind of been something that I gravitated to and I put a lot of work and heart into it. And so, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, down the line it becomes, you know, with all this information and stuff that I've amassed, that I'll be able to, you know, have a great windfall at some point, you know, to pay off for all this wonderfulness. But if I don't get paid another dime, it's just incredible to have been able to talk to certain people, especially ones that are no longer here, like Arif Martin, to talk to him about Donny Hathaway and the Average White Band and stuff is priceless. I can't even put a dollar amount on that. You know, to have had 2 hours on the phone with Sugarfoot, asking him everything under the sun I ever wanted to ask him, and now we lost him. He's one of my all-time favorite people in music, you know, but I
right.
got that time, you know. So these are the kind of things that, you know, that make my work, if I can even call it that, you know, extra satisfying, you know. It's like,
I know,
it's,
right?
It's play and it's work.
You can't even call it work, really. So what you need to do is go ahead and sit down and write this book. What are you waiting for?
There's a couple of different projects. I mean, I have not been completely sleeping on that. People always ask me, when are you going to write your book? And, you know, I last year, there's a book that I was very instrumental in editing, which is a book about the Fender Rhodes electric piano. I did one interview for that project, which was Les McCann, but a friend of mine, Gerald McCauley, you know, was working on that project with another gentleman named Ben Beauvais. They did a lot of interviews, and they, you know, did them initially for a documentary that's on video, and it's on DVD, and it's available. But then they start, you know, I ran into Gerald, and I told him if there was ever, you know, he showed me some footage on an iPhone or something of, like, Herbie Hancock. And I'm just sitting there watching this footage, you know, at a concert. I was at Catalina Bar and Grill at a Christian McBride concert, and I couldn't halfway focus on Christian because I'm sitting here watching Herbie talk about, you know, something or other. And with this Fender Rhodes, I said, if you guys ever get around to doing something writing-wise with this, I would love to be all in. And, you know, he jumped and took advantage of that right away. And so I ended up turning all of their Q&As into editorial. You know, I made it like a story, like the artist just telling you the story of
right.
how they got the instrument, how they got into playing it, what the instrument meant to them, and some of the greatest hits that they played on with this instrument, blah, blah, blah. So I edited that book, which is a beautiful Hal Leonard book. It's called Down the Rhodes, the Fender Rhodes story.
Mm-hmm.
And also helped another friend with a book. And, you know, so I kind of am a very tentative person in general. I don't like to jump into things. So I figured let me help some other people with their books, kind of see how this whole game works. And now I do have a couple of books of my own that I'm hoping to get out there. The publishing game is no joke these days. I mean, there's major stories that publishers are not putting out because they don't think they'll sell. So then you got to go into self-publishing and all sorts of other things
absolutely.
Like you did. Like you
absolutely.
Did.
Absolutely. That's how what I was getting ready to say.
I know you weren't going to give me no quarter on that. You know, you did your own book.
Absolutely. What you do
and
is you say, okay, mm-hmm. that's how you guys are playing this game. Okay, well, let me tell you. I got something for you. And all the history that you are a witness to, it's all about sitting down and doing it yourself. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
what I can't wait to you is talk about, to do with you is talk about your aspect on funk music. But before we do that, we got two phone calls, too, that are waiting. And so before we take the phone calls, I want to address this third song on your list called Fun by Sly Stone, and it is by Global Noise. They redid it. So tell us why you chose that song.
I chose that because I know you have a connection through Graham Central Station and Sly and the Family Stone. In fact, I remember reading something on Facebook. I believe you posted an excerpt from your book and or is an interview that you did with somebody else that where you were actually took part in a vocal session for, was it Love and Hate? Something off of
yeah.
There's a Riot
yeah.
going on?
Yeah,
yeah. So I just wanted to have something Sly-oriented in our show today. And Sly Stone was all up in my world last year because I wrote the liner note essay for this deluxe reissue of There's a Riot Going On. I interviewed Greg Errico, Jerry Martini, Cynthia Robinson, Amp Fiddler, and Lee Ritenour, all for to get different kinds of perspectives on Sly. I had to do this project very quickly. So I made an overture to try to get Sly, and that didn't work out. Couldn't get to Larry in time, and on and on and on. But I still think I delivered a really good essay for this classic album. There's a lot of information in there that I think a lot of people didn't know. But anyway, Global Noise is a group that was put together by my friend Jason Miles, who lives in New York, and he's a great keyboardist and synthesizer wizard, and he's worked with Miles Davis, Luther Vandross, Joe Sample, so many people, and he's produced a lot of records that are tribute-oriented. He did one for Weather Report. He did one called Groovin' for Grover, which was a tribute to Grover Washington Jr., is another artist that he worked with. But last year, he put out a record called Sly Reimagined, with his group Global Noise. And Global Noise is a real progressive kind of group. They have vocalists from different parts of the world. They have turntablists, you know, horns, rhythm section, and Jason playing keyboards and producing everything with his, you know, wonderful texture, texturizing work with keyboards and synths. And so they do a lot of covers. They have Nona Hendrix on the record doing In Time and a couple of other songs and, you know, a lot of different guests. But I chose Fun because it's really funky, and I know that that's what you're into here on this show. So I wanted Fun to be on here. And it features a singer named Maya Azucena, and it features turntablist DJ Logic, who's done a lot of work with folks like Marcus Miller and whatnot. So the album is called Sly Reimagined. Jason Miles with his group Global Noise, and the song is a new version, real funky, of Sly Stone's Fun.
Here we go.
Wow.
So,
and I think I want to give out a shout-out to that saxophone player who I'm dashing to the credits here. I think his name is Ron Holloway. He was getting off on it. I just want to make sure that he's acknowledged. Ron Holloway.
Okay. And what amazes me is a song like that, listen to it for so many years one way, and to hear somebody just take it and still keep it funked up in a totally different aspect blows my mind, you know. So
yeah.
I thought that was really, really, really interesting. And guess what? I'm going to sock it to you as I would have you sock it to me. Is that all right?
Sock it to me.
So just remember that. Okay, so let's go to some of these phone calls right quick. Let me see. Area code 626. Area code 626, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Good. Who is this calling?
This is Robin Russell.
All right.
Robin
so,
Russell. Do you know who that is?
Robin Russell.
Sounds like somebody you know.
It is. It's somebody you should know.
Is it?
He's an incredible drummer who was a member of one of the baddest R&B bands in the land in the 70s, right along with y'all.
Who? Tell me who. Who?
New Birth.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? Shoot. Hi, Robin.
How you doing?
I am just wonderful. Thank you so much for calling in. What do you have to say to your buddy?
Right on, Scott. I love it. I'm loving the show, and I'm loving hearing the history, you know, because, you know, as well as I know you, a lot of those things I didn't know, and it's just good to hear it, to see how that picture came to be.
Right. Isn't it wonderful?
Man. I am honored that you are even calling in and taking your time to do this, man. It means a million to me, man. It's awesome, man. Thank you.
Well,
yeah,
thank
there's always
you.
Something. I'm always shocking Robin because Robin, for the longest time, knew that I played drums, but he didn't really know. And that picture that you posted of me, Chocolate,
right.
with the drums, that's me in Griffith Park on Robin's drums. And he let me sit down and play for a while. And he went for a walk around the park while I was playing, and he, you know, he was just checking me out the whole time. And Robin is mad cool, and he doesn't cuss or anything. But he came back and he said one of my favorite things. He just sat in the grass after he listened to me play for about 15 minutes, and he went, "Dang," and that's Robin. He said, "Dang,
God, you've got it. You've never lost the touch. I never will forget that day. I love it. I love it."
So, Robin, what are you doing right now?
Right now, I'm still playing. I just kind of got over an injury. I had a back injury. A disc kind of out of place. It kind of took me out of pocket for about 6 months. But I'm back in the swing of things now, just getting things back together. And I've been doing a few gigs around, and so I'm just kind of getting back in motion.
Right,
I
understand.
Lost a thing either. That brother plays all the time. He takes his drum set out to Griffith Park at least a few times a week, and he will play from sun up to sundown, literally. And he is still incredible. So anybody out there looking for a bad drummer and with some history and all the funk and everything up in it that you need, get at this brother. I'm serious. I want to see him doing a whole lot more. So I'm putting that out in the universe.
I'm putting out in the universe is you and I need, because listen, you talking about history, you are all up in the middle of history, my brother. So your story is one that needs to be told on Everybody is a Star. So you don't have to, you can lay down and tell your story on my show.
Okay, well, I would love to do that.
Yeah, we got to hook that up. And thank you. See, A. Scott Galloway, he knows everybody. See?
Yes, he
does. You know what I'm saying? So,
yes, he does. It's amazing.
He is out there. And he doesn't know it. I am just, I am just stoked about him being on the show, and especially with the sponsors like you calling up, you know, and you guys are friends. I think that is awesome, and I really appreciate you, and I know that Scott is like, I can hear him grinning.
I am, because yeah, this is what I'm all about. I love connecting. I love that you guys are having this interface. I could just, like, not even talk anymore and just let you guys do your thing but you know, he needs his own show, and some people need to hire him and get him back on the road and in the studio doing some things, and I just, you know, I want all that to happen. So I'm so glad he called in and that you guys got to rap. I am grinning over here big time.
Good.
Well,
very good.
You. And Chocolate, your work with Graham Central Station was just, you're one of a kind, definitely.
Oh, well, thank you, my brother. You know, I was just caught up. The funk took me before I knew it. I was gone, and all the rest is a blur. But you know, I do remember some of it. You know, when that funk catches you up, it's nothing you can do but just ride. You just got to
ride.
You know what I'm saying?
That's right. That
so I just
right.
put a saddle on it, and I just rode it, and I'm just still here to tell about it, which is why I'm, you know, it's so awesome talking to you, because you are someone that can still tell about it, you know, because there aren't many less that can really, who lived it, that can really tell about it. You know what I'm saying?
That's true. It's such a blessing to still be here and to still have, you know, my limbs, my talent is still here after all these years. So
that's right.
Definitely.
That's right. Okay. Well, thank you. Scott, you have anything else you want to say?
Well,
hey,
you know, it was a pleasure once again, and, you know, we will hook up. I would love to do the show, and, you know, it's always good hooking up with Scott. We've had some good time listening to music and going to concerts and having dinner and just having a good vibe, you know. So it's just good. It's a real good feeling.
And
well,
again, he's another one of my drum idols, one of the guys just, you know, that I listen to. And so for him to become not just somebody that I interviewed and said, okay, that was great, you know, for him to become a friend, like a real friend,
right.
Is just priceless and beautiful and you know, one of the best perks of what I do.
I hear you, and it's an honor, and I thank you so much, and may the funk be with you, my brother.
Well, thank you. Have a good
evening. All right, Robin, I'll get at you this weekend, man.
Okay. Bye.
Peace.
All right. Okay, Scott. So now, what I want to talk about right now is, let me see, did I get everybody? I think I got everybody. I'm saving this one person because I want them in on the conversation, on this funk conversation. Now, we briefly spoke before the show about, I asked if you had seen that funk documentary that was just on VH1. We briefly talked about it. But what I want to know is what is your position on funk music right now as far as, you know, how it's being represented and where it stands in funk music, in music history?
I got hit up about a year or so ago in front of the nightclub on Pico, the Mint. I went to go see somebody. I think it was my buddy Slap, Jarrah Harris and Slapback. I think that's who was playing that night. And some guys were just kind of bum-rushed me and had me, got me on video talking about funk because they were putting together a documentary, a different one from the one that Nelson George and Amir Questlove Thompson did. And I was just kind of trying to tell them that, you know, I came out of that. I was a product of that, you know, and that music was so inspiring, and it got us, you know, in the neighborhood, in our garages, playing instruments. And, I mean, you know, we still had music in the schools back then, but, you know, a lot of what you need for the funk, you know, it's just about you got to get in a room with people and you got to collaborate and you got to do the do. You know, you got to put in the time. You got to learn how to work with people and get your dynamics together and live the life of funk. You know, that's how it has to work. Today we look at a lot of music that, you know, after the producer era, you know, it got to be so much about like one or two cats putting everything together with, you know, machines and everything. And we all know that story. I don't want to really go all into that. But what's promising is when you see like Daft Punk that was on the Grammys this year, and they had pulled not just Nile Rodgers up on that stage, but Nathan East on bass and Omar Hakim on drums and just, you know, cats that could really do the thing, you know, playing the music. That's what it's all about. I don't think funk ever went anywhere, because in L.A. I could still go to clubs and see bands like Slapback and whatnot, you know, doing their thing. They're not on the radio. They're not getting the love that they need, you know. A lot of people would think that, you know, funk is something that kind of stopped in the early 80s or whatever. But it didn't. It never went anywhere. It went back underground where it was in the first place, but it hasn't gone anywhere. And I just think it's a matter of getting that bug again to want to play instruments, to want to get in a room together and hash it out and know their history, but be of a mind to want to, you know, tell their own stories through that music. You know, I don't know if it's ever going to be as great as it was back in the day, because I also have another stance that I truly believe the musicians from back in that period, just it was a golden era, you know, it's a golden period where you have somebody like Bernie Worrell, who spent 15 years or whatever, how many years, you know, studying classical music, you know, in his mother's living room and, you know, and maybe playing in church and then sneaking out and getting into George Clinton's band and bringing all that knowledge and all that skill and creativity and outness to what they were doing. And you know, people were listening to jazz and blues, and God, they had grown up with all of that in their sphere, and they, you know, they were bringing serious musicianship, you know. When you look at the Ohio Players or any band like that, I mean, these cats, you know, they get labeled as funk bands, but they could play anything. I say this all the time. I mean, Billy Beck, oh, my God, you know, you had him on your show, and that's the first show of yours that I listened to, you know, top to bottom. I was like, that's my man. I interviewed him, too. I mean, that man is incredible, you know. The keyboardists in those bands were really the ones a lot of times that had that whole other thing going on. I mean, they had the classical training, they had like the theory and harmony training and all that, and it helped kind of organize or flesh out what everybody else was doing, which is not to take away from the musicianship of any other members of those bands. But when I think about Kevin Tony and the Blackbirds, or Larry Dunn and Earth, Wind & Fire, Bernie Worrell and P-Funk, those gentlemen had crazy music. So I think I'm going all off, you know, in a whole bunch of directions on your question, but my basic stance on the funk is, like I said, it you know, there was a golden era. I think that it never went anywhere, and I think that it can definitely resurface if, you know, we get enough people to respect it and pay attention to it. And I'm so glad that we're seeing things like Nelson George in Questlove's documentary and this other documentary that I took part in called Funk the Movie, I believe is what that was called. And, you know, I mean, there's those of us, we just recognize it and we love it and we're not going to let it die. And you and what you're doing with your radio show and what Ricky Vincent did with his book on funk. And, you know, I mean, we're not letting it go quietly into the night. You know, it's still around, and I'm glad to be a part of the people that helped to document it, and I really, really like being a part of helping the people that pioneered it to continue to have a place in the marketplace today, and hopefully we'll get to one of the last, there's two more songs remaining, and one of them is from an original funketeer that is still doing the thing big time, and that's what I really like to support. I want to see some young people doing it. The veterans have a thing or two left that they want to say, and I always like to make sure that they get to say it and get heard.
Okay, well, with that, before I voice my opinion, I'm going to bring in, I hope he's still there, area code 305, you still there?
Hello.
Is that you, 305?
No, that was me saying hello.
Oh, that was you?
Oh, man, did they leave?
Okay. Well, I can't believe he did. Maybe he'll be back. But anyway, it was and I'm a, he's going to get it, but he's been waiting to get another show. But it was Stozo. You know who Stozo is, right?
Stozo? No, who is that?
Stozo is the one, the artist who created most of P-Funk's album covers.
Oh, wow. Wait a minute. I remember Pedro Bell. And so he did which ones? The Funkadelic? Which covers
yeah,
did he do?
That's why he was supposed to answer so he could we could have this talk so he could tell you. But he did he did most of them in the beginning. He
okay.
did several of them. I can't tell you exactly which ones he did, but he did them. He did them for that whole P-Funk camp. He did them for it was several different artists, as you know, that came out of that camp. So he did like album covers for most of them. You know,
okay.
like the cartoon. Okay, it says here that he is still there. 305, you there? Stozo. Okay, he'll be back. But anyway, he's my partner in everything funk. And we have a page called Funkolution on
mm-hmm.
Facebook. And what Funkolution is about is about change. It's a change as far as funk music goes. Now,
mm-hmm.
briefly, because we do still have a couple of songs that of yours that we want to play, but my stance on funk music is this, is that, you know, at this point I am tired of and disappointed in the fact that, you know, the term funk is being exploited. Like when you know, there was a time when you would go to a funk concert and there would be, and that's what it would be. It would be a funk concert. There would be,
yeah.
You know, Grand Central Station, Ohio Players, George Nairn, whoever it was, it would be funk. But these days and times, when you see funk attached to an event or a festival or whatever, you might get there and you might see anybody or anything playing. But it will have nothing at all to do with the funk, in my opinion, nothing. So I need for it to get back to the aspect of when you go, when you see something advertised as a funk fest or a funk whatever it is, that's who you are going to see, funk artists. You know what I'm saying?
Right. It's just like jazz festivals and blues festivals. It's
yeah.
the same thing.
Yeah.
They just become like catch-alls for, you know, just some kind of a music festival. And because they think that, you know, yeah, like you said, they exploit it. You know, well, this is called a funk festival. And then you get there and it's something else, you know. It's
Yes. Then you get there and the Delphonics are on it, which I have nothing against the Delphonics, of course. But, you know, what I'm saying is if you're going to call it funk, then let it be funk. So that bugs the heck out of me, number one. Number two.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that bugs me is in all these documentaries that you see that are supposedly funk documentaries, they seem to forget the role that women play. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Women
mm-hmm.
are like integral to the funk movement. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And so I'm not understanding why women of funk are being left out of, you know, this resurgence. You know what I'm saying? And so
yeah.
that needs to be fixed. So I'm on a mission to fix that for sure, because there's too many of them out there. Last week, I had as my guest Sandra St. Victor. You know who she is?
Oh, hallelujah. Well, I'm the one that,
okay.
that told you to do the Sugarfoot is Dead, to ask her about
that.
And
right.
you did
okay,
credit
that
me.
Was you
did credit me. It was,
okay.
And you did say my name on the show. And
okay,
I was going to mention something about that later. But that was my favorite
good.
Piece of music last year. And she's bad.
Right.
She's a writer.
Yeah.
She is everything. Serious
right.
lady. Yeah.
Right. So her, Joyce Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
Rose Stone, Cynthia
Robinson.
Who else?
Betty Davis.
Betty Davis and myself. Let me humbly throw myself in there.
That's right.
You know
the Ladies of Undisputed Truth. You know, the original
there you
ones.
Go.
And,
so, you know,
so
keep
many.
Going, keep going. You can
Jessica,
name them.
Please.
Jessica, please. I was trying to get her. I'm still working on her. Now, Shaka, of course, we all know about her, but it seems like that whenever, you know, anytime anything is brought up about funk or documenting funk, you know, the go-to funk diva is Shaka, but it goes so far past Shaka. You know, she is not the only one, and so we all know about Shaka.
She tell you Leilani Washburn. She tell you about Leilani and other people like that too. I mean, there's a lot of them that just never got as big as Shaka. I mean, she is kind of that poster woman for the funk. But that, like you said, there were so many
that were left. Malia Franklin, I left her out. But so many. So, you know, I'm on a mission to make sure that gets corrected. That's number two. Number three is, and then I'm going to leave it at this, number three is, you know, somehow there are a lot of reasons people, because I'm always asking this question, and I have to a lot of different people, and they mostly all say the same thing. Somehow, George Clinton and the whole P-Funk camp are the go-tos when it comes to funk music. You know what I'm saying? And it is so far past George, so far past. Of course George has his place. Of course we all love George, P-Funk, and everything that has to do with P-Funk.
Bootsy.
But, Bootsy, all of those, we love them. But, no, what about all the funk that came out of Ohio? What about all the funk that came out of Texas and Texas, which would be Sly, which would be Larry, which would be, I was born in Texas, but a whole bunch of funk came out the
Oklahoma.
South. Thank you, Oklahoma. You know what I'm saying? It's so many aspects of it. And it was like funk was going on before George. And the fact that whenever, you know, you see these funk documentaries and stuff, you know, George is the go-to person. And that gets on my nerves. You know, I love George P. Funk and all that. I love him. I do. Don't get me wrong. Nobody out there, I don't want no letters. I love him. But it goes past George. That's all I'm saying. And
that's
so,
all she's saying.
You know, that's all I'm saying. So that is my take on it. And so
I agree with you 100%. And, you know, the problem is with these TV kind of programs and all that kind of thing, they always go to the biggest of the big and the, you know, the most colorful and the most all of that. And, you know, that's fine, but that's why there has to be these other, you know, writings and documentaries and other things that are done. Because, you know, when you get into the commercial realm, that's just the way it is. You know, they're always going to go for the big, easy names that so many people are going to know. But they need to know about Buddy Miles. They need to know about what the Gap Band did before they became the Gap Band. And they need to know about Rick James. They need to know about so many other, you know, then Leilani Washburn. Graham Central Station and the jazz side of things and the blues side of it, Buddy Guy. I mean, come on, you know.
Right.
It's a lot. It's a lot. And
right.
I agree with you 2,000%.
Okay, good. I'm glad. If you agree with me, it's all good. I don't care what nobody else says.
I got your back, baby. I got you.
So now we are going to go and move to, besides Water, of course, I really like this song, Change in the World. Tell us about Change in the World.
Oh, my goodness. This is my girl, Nikki Richards. Now, this is my favorite contemporary artist, period. You know, and it kind of, I get resentful sometimes when I see, you know, I mean, I like Alicia Keys, don't really care so much for John Legend. So many artists that are out there, that are getting a whole lot of push from a major record company and a lot of money thrown at them and a lot of this and a lot of that. But Nikki is truly the real deal. This young lady is in New York City by way of Honolulu. She's been all around the world. She is a singer, a songwriter, an arranger, producer, plays keyboards and a lot of other instruments, and she's learning the bass now. She's worked her way from, you know, I mean, she can go from the forefront to singing backup for Madonna, Whitney, Mariah. You know, she had her first album on Atlantic in the early 90s, and it didn't, you know, it was a great record, didn't do anywhere near what it needed to do. She just regrouped and did a whole lot of stuff behind the scenes. And in the last few years, she put out two albums on her own label, which is called Hydrus Music. And the first one was just called Nikki, and her most current one is called Tell Me. And this one album alone, she's got a song called Kiss, Kiss, Kiss that would blow Rihanna stuff out of the water. She lyricized Herbie Hancock's Tell Me a Bedtime Story incredibly, and then got Randy Brecker to play trumpet on it and Christian McBride to play bass on it. She's got a funk song that will flip your lid, Chocolate, called Spaceship. Mm-hmm. She's got a song called Queen that's a dance anthem for ladies, and then a really, really sexy song called Hungry where she sings and also has spoken word. I mean, I could go on and on. She's my favorite artist. She's so talented, and yet, you know, people really only know her for things like being the primary vocalist for Madonna. So that's got to change. So this song, I could have picked any of those songs I just mentioned, but I wanted to play Change in the World for two reasons. One, because you, and on Ain't No Bout to Doubt It, did the Ann Peebles jam, I Can't Stand the Rain. Well, this song by Nikki, Change in the World, has that same kind of Willie Mitchell, High Records, Memphis vibe to it. Nikki's doing all the vocals, singing, you know, she's playing keyboards, synthesizer programming, drum programming. She's got a horn section on here. She's got the great Lenny White, who was like her greatest mentor on drums. She's got, you know, bass guitar, guitarist Sherrod Barnes, and bassist Artie Reynolds. Great, great song, and it's a wonderful message, and she's taking it to church. And she's got her people
yes,
on here singing
is.
Background. Tawatha
like
A.G.,
it.
Vanice Thomas, and Fonzie Thornton.
Tawatha?
Tawatha?
Yeah,
Tawatha's
here.
On here. She hangs with those. Those are her people. I mean, and she loves them, as, you know, as much or more than the main people, like the star people that she works for. You talk about everybody's a star. You go on Nikki's Facebook page, and she's always showing you pictures of her with her people, you know, her background singers that she sings with. She's doing the BET Honors right now, this weekend. She's very much in demand. She's the bomb. So anyway, I could talk about her forever. People that know me know I'm crazy about some Nikki Richards. So I just want the world to hear this song, Change in the World. Listen to the message. Listen to the music. And know that this woman wrote this and produced it and put all these people together to blow your mind.
Here we go.
That's my girl.
Okay. And you were right. The homegirl took it straight to church. When I first heard that, I said, oh, I like this one.
Mm-hmm.
This
I knew
is a good
would.
One.
That's
that
why
girl,
I picked
yeah.
that one.
I did. That girl knows she's singing. So, okay, you guys, if you didn't know, now you know. You heard it on Everybody Is a Star. Okay?
That's right.
Nikki Richards.
Her album's called Tell Me. She put it out on her own label, her own money. She invested. She saved from that Madonna tour and all that stuff she did and turned around and made that record. 14 songs. She's bad.
That's what I'm talking about. She is bad. Okay, so time is winding up. So, see, I told you this 2 hours was going to fly by. So
I knew it would.
Okay, so what's next for A. Scott Galloway?
Like I said, I have a couple of book things I can't really talk about yet that I'm hoping to get out there. I've kind of got my feet wet doing things for other people, so now they'll hopefully I can get some things happening that are A. Scott Galloway pieces. I'm currently doing everything from the bio for Mickey Howard's new album to liner note essay on a reissue of the Wailers. Band album Majestic Warriors, which is the second album they did after Bob Marley passed away. I already interviewed Junior Marvin. I'm waiting to get Family Man. You know, this is another one. This is my life. I'm on hold waiting for Aston Family Man.
Right.
You know, Barrett, mm-hmm. bass player. I think he's in Jamaica. They're somewhere. They're about to tour somewhere. But I'm going to get him. If I have to do it at 2 in the morning somewhere, I just want at least those two perspectives. So,
right.
you know, that's me. I'm always going to be doing some liner notes. I'm always going to be helping, you know, my friends with press releases and bios and that sort of thing. But I do intend this year to step it up and have some kind of book, if not published, at least written and read to go by the end of the year.
Yay. So where can we go to find out what you're doing? What give us your information?
I don't really have a website or anything. People that want to reach me, just come and say hello to me on Facebook. That I'm on my computer all day doing stuff, and so I always have my Facebook up. You can reach me there under A. Scott Galloway. And if you want to know my credits, at least in liner notes, go to All Music Guide. They have about 95% of them up there. I'm very proud of all that work. And just reach out. If you reach out to me on Facebook, you know, we can chat. And, you know, depending on what you want from me, you know, I'll give you my email, phone number, whatever it is, whatever we can do, or however I can help you, I'll be glad to do it.
All right. You got any shout-outs?
Oh, my goodness. I had a bunch of them. I see we only got, like, 3 minutes left. But I did just want to shout-out my parents, my family. I wanted to shout-out all my Facebook friends. I got so many other friends that are coming out with great music. Preston Glass and his wife Gina, Latanya Holmes got a wonderful version of Love Hangover going on out there right now. Kevin Phyllis and Dominique Tony, that's Kevin Tony from Blackbirds. His daughter's coming with an incredible record. Her name's Dominique. James McKinney and Carolyn Malachi, Bob Baldwin, Rio Virginie, Charmaine Clamore. My goodness, Savoir Faire. Don Mizell, Judy Cheeks, Cheryl Barnes, Anthony Jefferson, all my friends out in Dominican Republic, all my
oh
people.
Oh, my God. He's
Kim,
going
Tony.
Around the world.
I wanted to try to reach
world.
Out to everybody. Terrell Hannah at the Urban Music Scene, David Mitchell at Amalgamation, Donald Cleveland at Purpose Music, David and Michael at Soul Music Records, Paul Williams at Real Music, and Val Jennings at Edsel. I could go on and on. I wanted to dedicate this to the memory of two gentlemen I worked with, Graham Armstrong and Jerry Boulding, who passed away this last year. And I did want to give a shout-out to Miss Sandra St. Victor because Sugarfoot is Dead, truly, the message and everything behind it, that was my anthem for last year. So I didn't get to call in and talk to her last week, but please know that's my girl and that is my song.
Okay. Now, did you have a little drop that you were going to do for me right quick?
That's right. This is A. Scott Galloway on the Everybody is a Star show, hanging with my girl Patrice Chocolate Banks for the first time of many more times to come. And you need to always be tuned into whatever she's doing on Friday night. Forget going out on Fridays anymore. Just come and hang out with your girl Chocolate on Friday night and get your funk on.
All right. That's what I'm talking about. Okay, for all things chocolate, you can go to PatriceChocolateBanks.com, shouting out my family, the Facebook Nation, Team Chocolate, all you Funkalutionaries, BBJ, Beverly Black Johnson, Tribe Family Channel, One Love. May the funk be with all y'all. And we're going to go out on Scott's last song that he submitted, Rome Dog, Roman 2. We don't have time to explain it, but listen to it. Well, just tell them who it is right quick.
This is Jerome Bigfoot Braley from P-Funk. You remember the drums from Tear the Roof Off the Sucker, Do That Stuff, and Endangered Species? This is the man. He's got his own band called Mutiny, and this track is just him on the drums and the great grand mixer DXT on the turntables. You remember him from Herbie Hancock's Rocket. Hit it.
All right, all right. All right, everybody, love y'all. Here we go. Everybody's a star. See y'all later.
Love you, Chocolate. Thank you.
Love you, too.
Gonna give a straight bone.